You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Today, we are in La Planche des Belles Filles.
Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hi, Richard.
And we're standing in a field, but where exactly is that field, Lionel?
Do you know? I'm not entirely sure where we are. We're at the bottom. Champigny. Thank you, Daniel. Champigny. We're in what is basically a kind of an agricultural industrial estate. We've spent the afternoon in the press room, which I imagine the rest of the year is used to store hay bales or churns of milk or something. But it's we're in the Vosges. We're probably about 8 miles from the top of Planche des Belles Filles, where the stage finished today.
Yes, and what a stage. We've lost another man down. Alberto Contador crashed, is out of the race. He rode on for about 18 kilometres with what we now know as a broken tibia, or fractured tibia. So, you know, that he looked in pain, he looked very uncomfortable, his team waited for him. And it was complicated because the peloton did ease up in sort of accordance with the unwritten rule that you don't take advantage of a rival's crash. But there was quite a dangerous situation developing with Mikhail Kwiatkowski.
Mikhail
Kwiatkowski up the road.
It's funny, I was talking to Greg LeMond about this, and he had a terrible time the other day trying to figure out how he was going to pronounce this. I know this is a bit of a recurring theme on the podcast, and pronunciation of difficult names, but Greg had called Soigneur at Omega Pharma Quick Step. I can't remember which Soigneur it was, but someone Greg knew from his own career. And the message that came back was it should be pronounced something like Schwatkowski. And Greg was adamant that he was going to pronounce it like this on air on Eurosport, and Kathy was adamant that Greg would not pronounce it like this. Kathy, his wife, who features in the Cycling Podcast blog today very prominently, and she was adamant that he shouldn't pronounce it like that. He would open himself to ridicule. So the ongoing mystery of Mikhail Kwiatkowski's name and how it's pronounced.
Well, I understand the L doesn't get mentioned, doesn't get pronounced on Micho. So it's more Michor, so because it's an L with a line through it. So the Polish football team is from the town of Łódź, which is looks like an L to us, but an L with a line through it. O D Z.
There is
pronounced with a W.
I'm going one last thing. There is an excellent. There is an excellent web link that has been compiled by one of our followers who is from Poland, has a Polish name, which I'm not going to try to pronounce, but I'm going to find this web link and I'm going to post it on the Cycling Podcast Twitter feed, and it tells you how to pronounce all of the Polish riders' names.
Co-favourite for the Tour de France crashes out with a broken leg, and we're discussing okay. How to pronounce Michał Kwiatkowski's name.
We also got pulled up on Twitter by somebody for pronouncing Jakub Fuglsang's name incorrectly. Don't just tell us we're not pronouncing it correctly, tell us how to pronounce it. That would be really helpful.
Phonetically, yeah. Tweet us with phonetics so we can get it right.
I know that a Danish journalist listens to the podcast, Lars, and I looked for him today and I couldn't find him, but I'm going to get a lesson from him in Jakob Fuglsang, although we might not be talking about him
Lars,
that much.
Jørgensen.
Nice one, Daniel. Anyway, what a stage. Alberto Contador is out of the Tour. Most people's favourite to win. He was 2.5 minutes down on Vincenzo Nibali. We were really looking forward, I think, to seeing him try to claw that time back. He's an aggressive rider anyway. He would have had to be aggressive. By some accounts, he was aggressive on the particular stretch of road where he crashed. And there is some debate about exactly where it was, whether it was downhill or on the flat. He must have been going pretty fast because he obviously very badly hurt. But both Jürgen van den Broek and Jakob Fuglsang claimed afterwards that he was taking too many risks when he fell. We've seen this before with Contador. We saw it last year on the stage into Gap where he overshot the road, and Chris Froome later said that he was taking too many risks. On the Col de Sorène as well, the couple of days later coming off Alpe d'Huez, again, he got away there with Roman Kreuziger, having probably taken a few risks on the descent. It's the way he likes to race. But yeah, I mean, I want to say more about this whole issue actually of dissent. We've spoken before in the podcast about how the margins now are so small in professional cycling that I think, whereas in the past, and especially on a rainy day like today, there may have been some kind of unofficial truce on dissents. They weren't raced in the way that they are now. They are being raced now, and there are riders who are willing to take to gamble there because that's where the margin could be. And there are lots of speculation about what's causing all the crashes this year, and they've been crashing in the flat as well. Who knows? But I do think that riders are willing to take more risks.
Well, yeah, I think just on Jürgen Vandenbroek, he tweeted, I think the specifics about Contador's crash will come out in the wash on the rest day when people have a chance to explain what they saw, what happened. But Jürgen Vandenbroek did tweet that Contador was out of the saddle trying to overtake people, perhaps move up the bunch, and he hit a pothole and went down, and that's how the crash was caused. So we'll see whether that gets confirmed tomorrow.
Rich, you talk about people taking more risks. Well, one possibility is that they're taking more risks because the equipment now is so much better or so much faster, and it allows them, or they think it allows them, to take more risks. And you know, we're very used now to seeing figures relating to how quickly people are going up climbs, you know, times on, we get that pretty much every day, but I would be very interested to see, you know, for specific descents and also on average, are riders going down certain descents much quicker than they used to?
That would be fascinating to see. We had a brief conversation the other day in the Start Village with Tim Harris, a former British professional who drives VIPs on the Tour de France every year. Tim's always got something to say, and we were talking about crashes, and he was blaming the equipment. He just thinks that the you were there as well, Lionel. Yeah. What specifically was the cause? As far, because it's not just the fact that it's lightweight, because it's not. There are obviously rules about how light a bike can be. It's something about the liveliness of the equipment.
Well, I think the stiffness, particularly the carbon wheels, carbon frame sets, you know, very little give in the frames. And he was making the point that as a junior, as an amateur, and as a professional, he raced many times down the Kemmelberg, which is the cobbled climb in Belgium, but also famous for having a cobbled descent. And he said, you know, we as generations and generations of riders raced up and down that climb without much of a problem. With he said he's never seen a crash on the descent when he was racing. And in recent years, they've had to change the descent off the Kemmelberg to go down the paved, almost footpath, instead of going down the cobbles, which are incredibly steep. But that was partly as a result of a crash for Jimmy Casper, where they all thundered down the cobbles, bottles were bouncing out of the bottle cages, and Jimmy Casper landed on his face. Daniel, you watched the World Cup final with Jimmy Casper last night. Just a little link there.
He seemed quite ambivalent, I must say, about the World Cup final.
Fair enough. The bikes are incredibly stiff, and if you've ridden a modern bike, there's obviously, you know, that stiffness has plenty of pros, but perhaps one of the cons is that when they take a jolt on a bad road surface, they're particularly unforgiving.
Can I just say as well that a lot has been made this year, and we've made a lot about the difficulty of the stages in the Vosges. Christian Prudhomme was very excited about how difficult the Vosges were going to be this year, and Prudy, of course, who we'll probably see at any moment, because he usually appears at the press room around this time.
We've seen him answering a call of nature in a field not unlike this.
We have. But one thing that wasn't mentioned about the Vosges is that it's often wet here. We only have to look around, see how green it is, and you know, stages in the recent history of the Tour have often been affected by rain in the Vosges. Remember Heinrich Hausler in 2010 winning a soaking wet stage. But they are dangerous. You know, that there is a history of the Tour de France and the Vosges causing crashes and causing, you know, big favourites to crash out. One very notable occasion when that happened was the 1969 Tour, when Luis Ocaña fell on the descent of the Grand Ballon, not to be confused with the Petit Ballon, where Alberto Contador fell, where he fell at the bottom of the descent today.
Thinking of that stage in 2010 that Henrik Hausler won, was there not two riders shot on that day as well?
Yeah, Oscar Freire and someone else.
So the Vosges are very dangerous indeed.
I should say, shot by like a pellet gun, not with an actual...
It wasn't fatal.
No, it wasn't. It certainly wasn't. But the staggering thing about Contador, and we'll come on to the impact it's going to have on the race, but he broke his fractured a bone in his leg and carried on for reportedly 18 kilometres. The Tinkoff Saxo teammates waited for him, and then he called it a day and got into the team car. And I gather, is it not today that Oleg Tinkoff arrived on the race? Is that right? Or did he arrive yesterday?
It was yesterday.
He arrived yesterday. Well, even so. But Contador wasn't the only one to crash badly. Thiago Machado, lying third overall.
Nice pronunciation, Lionel.
Lying third overall this morning, also crashed heavily. It was reported that he was out of the race, that he'd abandoned, but actually he hadn't. He crossed the line 43 minutes down last, and he's fallen to around about 47th place overall. So, as we've said, you know, this tour is turning into a kind of last man standing at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, and we did talk only last night about how essential it can be in trying to win the tour not to fall off, and we mentioned, I think, Contador doesn't often crash really at all, and there he is. He's crashed very heavily. Nibali is still not, he's not crashed, touch wood. Richie Porte is up to second, he's not crashed. You know, the guys that crash, it takes its toll. And TJ Van Garderen seems to have been recovering from his crash. He's right back into the top 10. And Andrew Talansky fell away again today, quite badly.
Possibly as a result of those couple of crashes.
Well, that's the thing. They do take the toll in terms of, you know, interrupting or affecting your sleep, and your body isn't then able to recover as well as it would if you're getting a proper night's sleep. So, yeah, it definitely takes a toll. It also puts strain on other parts of the body because it's obviously compensating for the parts that you've hurt and injured.
And, of course, psychologically, this isn't my big piece of Juan Antonio Fletcher news that I gave notice of yesterday, but I did speak to Juan Antonio Fletcher yesterday about his crash in the 2011 Tour de France, when famously he was knocked off the road by a television, and France television car. But he talked to me yesterday about how that crash really affected him for the last two or three years of his career. Whenever he was in a break thereafter, he was always pretty much terrified of the same thing happening. He said he couldn't really concentrate on the racing, couldn't really concentrate on the decisions that he should have been making in the break. He was just terrorized by the memory of that crash.
And I know, Daniel, you've spoken in the past, Christian van der Velde as well, about the fear that can follow a bad crash on a descent. And we've seen it with Thibaut Pinot as well. I'm not sure if he had a bad crash, but he had that fear, didn't he, on descents. Clearly he got through today very well. But we should also point out that riding your bike in the rain is pretty dangerous. And we noticed today that I think we've had rain every single day apart from Yorkshire. And that's quite exceptional because we're 10 stages into the tour, and it does make it more dangerous. And, you know, Chris Froome's first crash had nothing to do with the rain, but the following day I'm sure it did. Everything is more difficult, from visibility to you know, brakes not working the same and just nervousness.
Well, yeah, it puts the riders on edge, doesn't it? It makes that cliche about wanting to be at the front or wanting to be in the position you want to be in. It just puts a premium on every single move that the riders make. And their nerves must be frayed now. In fact, a few people this morning talking about what a relentlessly nervous tour it's been so far. You know, I'm sure they'll be relieved to get to the rest day and the prospect of hopefully the weather improving a bit. Sunny here this evening.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib.
So let's talk about the stage winner. I think there was a sense of deflation that Alberto Contador playing at the race, and a sense that it left the race really wide open. And then a sense following the stage, almost that there's a feeling that, not that the tour is over, but that Vincenzo Nibali has emerged now as an outstanding favourite to win. He attacked. He had great team support from Michele Scarponi until he crashed on the descent before La Planche de Belfi. Got back on and was able to help again. Jakob Fuglsang had done his bit as well, but when Scarponi peeled off, Nibali just went. How far was that from the summit? About
2 kilometres.
2 kilometres. It's a short climb, 6 kilometres long, the climb. And Nibali went towards the end, got a decent gap, bridged up to Joaquim Rodriguez, who'd been away all day and is now in the King of the Mountains jersey, and then dropped him and won the stage. Now, it looked very impressive. The gaps aren't huge. The gaps on the stage were not huge. You know, he was finishing sort of 20 seconds ahead of Thibaut Pinot, I think, who got second. So is the tour not over, but Nibali, is it Nibali's to lose now, Daniel?
Yeah, I think so. I would sort of emphasise again how difficult this tour is. The Vosges are over now, but you know, we've got the next stage in a different mountain range, the Jura, on Wednesday after the rest day. And then we've got a bit of the massive Centrale to Saint-Étienne. Then we've got two really difficult mountain stages in the Alps, which I think have been underestimated because people perhaps don't know the finishes to Chamrousse and Rizal that well. You know, they're not well-known names. They're not Alpe d'Huez. They're not the Galibier. But they're very, very difficult, those two stages. Particularly the climb to Chamrousse is very, very long, about 17 kilometres. And then three brutish stages in the Pyrenees. So with difficult descents as well. I think the weather is going to clear up over the next few days. But if it starts to rain again in the Pyrenees, they could be equally treacherous. And there's a lot of racing left to do.
Let me just, add to my earlier comments that Thibaut Pinot was actually only 15 seconds down on Nibali. Most of the other guys were around about the 20 second mark.
And Thibaut Pinot had a lucky escape because he'd promised to retire if he won today, and he came within 15 seconds.
So he carries on. He carries on, and he's up to 6th overall. I mean, it's shaping up to be a good... We could have a Frenchman on the podium. Romain Bardet is up to 4th overall.
We could. I thought what was most interesting was how those younger French riders really look to Richie Porte first and perhaps Valverde of Movistar to do the running in that final stretch once Nibali had made his move. And Porte did take up the pace for quite a long time, held it at a really quite decent, Nibali was going extremely well, but Porte was limiting that gain, and then they kind of jumped him in the last 400 or 500 meters, which are particularly that last bit just before it levels out at the top. That's pretty much the steepest part of the climb. So in terms of clues as to how the rest of this race is going to pan out, Movistar and Sky still are going to have to do most of the challenging, because I think the likes of Romain Bardet, Thibaut Pinot, and even TJ Van Garderen, they will seek to profit, and they'll be much more sort of freelance type attackers rather than a sort of sustained team unified sort of assault on Nibali's lead.
Yeah, and just to go back to Pinot's performance, he's a real confidence rider, and he's suffered in the last year. Obviously his tour in 2003 went badly wrong when he had problems on a descent, on the descent of the Porte de Paillère in the first...
2013, I think that was.
What did I say?
2003.
All right, okay. It was probably 2013.
When he was 12.
Okay. So he had big problems last year. It all started to go wrong on the descent of the Porte de Paillère. Since then, there have been a lot of question marks about his mental robustness. And he is, a real confidence rider, and he'll have got a lot of confidence and self-belief from that ride today. He's been saying over the last few days that although he lives in a village which is pretty much overlooked by La Planche de Belfi, he rides it very often in training, but it doesn't suit him. It's not a climb that he particularly likes. So to come second and to look very, very good, particularly in the last kilometre, is going to be a huge, huge boost for him.
I mean, there was an impressive attack by Nibali, and he looked good. He looked as he's looked good all tour, and he's certainly improved from the Nibali we saw in the Dauphiné. But you know, already you can see sort of questions being asked about Nibali's performance. And tomorrow's a rest day, and traditionally that's when riders tend to be sort of interrogated and asked to justify their performances and reassure people that they're clean, etc. And those questions are absolutely legitimate and perfectly justified. But one thing to bear in mind watching Nibali is that he's not riding away like that from Chris Froome, Alberto Contador, Nairo Quintana. We are watching a race now that is really diminished. It might be a better race for that.
A bit decaffeinated, isn't it?
It's a bit decaffeinated. I don't think that will affect the enjoyment, the entertainment of the race. I think it's going to be an interesting race. I think Nibali is clearly the strongest rider in the race, but you know, his form this season has been so erratic, prompting that famous letter from Alexander Vinokourov, his boss, that I don't think he can be fully confident that he's going to maintain this all the way to Paris.
No, well, people were saying yesterday that they'd rather be Nibali's strength in the second half of the race rather than the first. And somebody like Richie Port, or as the French will know him, Richie Dor. Sorry, if Richie Dor can just
blow the doors off. No more of this cheap wine for Lionel, Daniel.
So you would want to be coming on strong in the final week. I mean, it is a cliche about the Tour, but Nibali has got to be at that level for a long, long way to go. And as Daniel says, you know, the middle week, although on paper it doesn't look sort of A-list in terms of where they're going, that, as you say, Chamrous is long, a real grind, and that's the sort of climb that would suit Richie Port really well.
Yeah, the one thing that makes me fairly confident about Nibali is that he's very sort of easy breezy in terms of dealing with all the kind of attendant pressures of being in the yellow jersey, the press conferences, the sort of media scrutiny. He's not someone that ever gives the impression that he's under any great burden. And you know, I think that sort of ability to deal with pressure mentally also obviously has a big effect on his physical freshness. And I don't really have too many doubts about his recovery, but as I said, it's a very complicated route between now and Paris.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Can I just a little plug for ourselves? Our pre-race predictions are shaping up pretty well at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, yours are, Lionel.
Well, mine, but also other people's are doing not too bad. I think Richard and I had Nibali in third place behind Froome and Contador, who have obviously both crashed out, so that's looking pretty
moral
good.
Victory.
Joaquim Rodriguez has just moved into the polka dot jersey,
Who predicted that, Lionel?
I predicted that one. I also tipped Leopold Koenig of NetApp Enduro to be one of the surprise riders of the race, and he was a very impressive eighth on the stage today. And Roman Bardet,
hugely impressive eighth place.
And Roman Bardet, who you both tipped for the white jersey, is now in that white jersey, so shaping up pretty well at the moment.
Eighth is Heimar Zubeldia's normal sort of place on the Tour, so he's nabbed that. Bardet, I think I tipped him for the white jersey as well. On Nibali, we should plug again our friend Ciro Scognamiglio's blog on thecyclingpodcast.com.
Hasn't appeared yet, has he? Neither Prudy nor Ciro has appeared. We were expecting them any moment.
We are waiting for Ciro, because Ciro... Here's the bus. I bet he's on one of these buses. We're going to hopefully get Ciro on the podcast for a cameo appearance. Yes, you can find Ciro's blog on www.thiscyclingpodcast.com. You can find us at @cycling_podcast and on Facebook as well. If you like us on Facebook, you stand a chance of winning a pair of Oakley sunglasses. We've been running a competition to win a phone call from Jonathan Vauters. The winner of that competition will be announced in the next section.
Well, that looks like a bus full of tourists or volunteers, tour makers, not a bus of journalists, it doesn't look like, coming back from the summit. Can we just have a quick word about the two Tonys? Tony Galopin, who set off in the yellow jersey on Bastille Day, was talking this morning about trying to defend it and that the Lotto Bellisol team would try to defend that lead. He hung on pretty well, but it was all too much for him in the end. But what about Tony Martin, who in the last 36 hours has spent 200 kilometres on his own at the front of the race, basically.
Well, on that note, I am going to introduce Ciro.
And now, Pedaleur de Charme.
Ciro introducing our Pedaleur de Charme, and I don't think my nomination of today and perhaps the Tour is Tony Martin. Not for his performance today, which was outstanding, but for not wearing polka dot shorts with a polka dot jersey. He was in the polka dot jersey, which he probably never expected. They probably didn't have polka dot shorts prepared for him, I wouldn't have imagined. But he didn't sully the polka dot outfit with a pair of horrible polka dot shorts. Mm. And I hope Joaquim Rodriguez doesn't do that either. I don't think he will.
Daniel, you made a point, I think, this morning that Tony Martin had asked to be kept apprised of the King of the Mountains competition, if there are any points still up for grabs on the summit. Yeah. So clearly he wanted to defend it.
Yeah, that's right. Just as he was leaving for the start today, I was there chatting to Brian Holm, one of the Omega Pharma Directors Sportifs, and Tony sort of interrupted our conversation. So not all that charming, because he did interrupt us. Not as rude as Jose Mourinho's interruption when I was talking to Brent Copeland in London.
Who could forget that?
Yeah. Tony Martin did make a point of asking Brian Holm to keep him abreast of any leftover points at the top of King of the Mountains.
Without being unkind to Tony Martin, he did go from pedaleur de charme to pedaleur sans charme in a split second when he pulled off the front.
Pedaleur dans squares. Yeah. I mean, when he finished his turn for Michał Kwiatkowski, he was doing a sterling job for Michał Kwiatkowski. And at one point, I thought Kwiatkowski was actually struggling to hold his wheel. Martin was just an absolute animal for a long part of the stage.
Tony Martin has had a lot of Tours de France where he's had to put up with physical problems. You know, I think he broke his wrist, did he, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
And that wasn't the only one. There have been other Tours de France where he's crashed or he's been ill, and he's been quite diminished for at least a part of the race. I just get the impression that we're finally seeing the real Tony Martin. That's not to say, as has been sort of suggested in previous years, that he could ever be a contender for general classification. That was something that people said early in his career. I don't think he's got that in him. However, we are seeing him at, you know, his full capacity this year.
Can I suggest something controversial?
Go on.
Can I suggest that if we were in an era of EPO and heavy blood doping,
yeah,
that Tony Martin, I don't see an awful lot between him and Jan Ullrich in terms of ability. They're both big riders, and I think what we saw in the blood doping EPO era was big riders being transformed into 3 week stage race riders. Is that fair to say? I mean,
It could be. I mean, it's purely speculative, isn't it? You know, the one thing that struck me again yesterday about Tony Martin, if you speak to coaches and anyone who's a real expert on time trialing, he just has such a unique body shape with these sort of very, very narrow kind of sloping shoulders that make it very easy for him to get very, very aerodynamic. And, you know, just a fantastic position on the bike, incredibly sort of steady, metronomic, again, as we saw today.
He's very pigeon-toed as well, isn't he? Had nothing to do with anything, really, but I just noticed that today, studying him riding on the front as he was. But when he finished his turn, I mean, that was it. It was he was sort of doing a track stand on the climb, wasn't he?
I think that really just shows to... I mean, somebody who... fairly new to cycling asked me by email today how come he can ride that hard and then just almost come to a standstill, but then keep going and finish only 16 minutes down. I mean, that's 16 minutes is quite a lot to lose, but he settled into a group and finished 16 minutes down. I think if you haven't ridden a bike over these kind of roads, at whatever level you've ridden at, it's the experience is quite similar. You can sort of empty the tank, and then it very, very slowly starts to kind of replenish a little bit. But you just can't reach those same sort of peaks of performance again once you've kind of run the tank purely down almost to empty, as Tony Martin did.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
We are standing here in a field at the base of La Planche des Belles Filles, and we're watching the buses disgorge the members of the media and people who've been up the climb, and strolling towards us, laptop open, bag on his shoulder, telephone in his hand, is one Ciro.
Like
Ciro Scogni Emilio.
I thought he was going to go straight past there.
Hello, everyone, and thanks also to our listeners, also for today to be listened.
Since you were last on the podcast, Ciro, you've been published on the website. Has this had a big effect on your sort of international profile?
Well, mostly a big effect on my motivation, because, dear Richard, I was thinking about this yesterday evening, yesterday night.
I know I haven't paid you for it yet. Yeah, it's in my pocket.
Don't worry, it doesn't matter. But I was thinking, how was my life without this podcast before? And also your life, our life, life of everyone. Without this, it's difficult to imagine now.
A pale shadow.
Yeah. Life is completely changed.
Come on, it's a business now, Ciro.
Yeah.
Nibali. National festival today. It's the French. It's Bastille Day, but really it's a day of festivities for the Italians.
Yes, really incredible second stage victory for Nibali, and both after Sheffield with the Italian national jersey. I mean, with polemical jersey, but anyway, it's the jersey of our champion. And certainly now for him, well, the road to Paris is still long, but now he's clearly the favorite of this tour. But I can add, if you want, I just was talking to him after the press conference while he was waiting for the anti-doping control. And certainly how the tour and also lives can be really a question of second, because he was thinking about the fall of Alberto Contador. And he told me that really for it has been a question of second, and maybe he could have also fallen out with Contador. So
is he sad about? I mean, did he say that he was sad for Contador?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, also they have a good relationship between them. They have each other also telephone number, and sometimes also they got some text. So yes, he was sad for this.
And you're confident that Nibali, we've seen him in outstanding form. The tour is only sort of 10 days old. Are you confident? Is he confident that he'll maintain that now?
I mean, about his form, yeah, I think he's confident, because he's trained to be at the top in this month. So he's confident for this, but maybe at least a little bit less confident for the episode that can happen in the race. As Froome, as Contador, this tour could be very strange, and maybe he also thinks in his mind, I don't know, that something also could happen also to him. So for that.
Okay, Ciro, you've probably got the whole of Gazzetta dello Sport.
Go,
run.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So it's great to hear from our old friend Ciro, and we'll be getting Ciro on the podcast more, of course, as well as Francois Thomazeau, who was an excellent guest last night, the French doyen.
Do you know what, Rich? I think we should dedicate a special podcast to the difference between a bistro and a brasserie. I know we glossed over it yesterday, but when he mentioned that he had written best-selling books about the best bistros in Paris and then the best brasseries, I was very intrigued about the difference between a bistro and a brasserie.
You really think we should dedicate a whole podcast to that?
I would like to, but Ciro's just sprinted off in the style of Pietro Mennea, the great Italian sprinter. Quite a sight to behold that was.
Did you find out what the difference between a bistro and a brasserie is?
Oh no, you're going to tell me?
No, I don't know. I'm now intrigued. You're right. That was a very interesting.
A brasserie. So a brasserie is a brewery, strictly speaking. But I think it might be fairly subjective, the difference these days.
Well, I saw Francois Thomazeau this morning, and he's very keen to come back on the podcast. He's very encouraged by some of the feedback that he got. So please keep that coming. If you enjoyed Francois's appearance on the podcast, please let us know. He'd even heard from some friends in Britain who reminded him that he'd forgotten to say the sort of strap line for the restaurant that he worked in Doncaster was, "The only French thing we have is Francois."
It was a French restaurant, though, wasn't it?
It was a French restaurant. If anybody in the Doncaster area knows the restaurant that Francois used to work in, that would be great to hear as well. Now, we've got a competition to announce. We have a lucky winner, winning a call from Jonathan Vauters, the Garmin Sharp team boss, on the rest day on Tuesday. So we had a lot of entries to that, and there were a few good ones. The point was to say in your tweet why he should call you. Jens Hagström very cleverly incorporated some Lionel Richie references into his tweet. Hello, if I get a JV call to talk all night long about my endless love of cycling, I'll be dancing on the ceiling. So that was good. That was appreciated. Well done, Jens. Laurent Audibert, French baroudeur, because my fiancé thinks Jonathan resembles Vector from Despicable Me, ready to rule the world. That also came close to winning, but our winner is Sonia in Germany. Sonia, and the reason she won is because I am intrigued by what she says. She says, to call me on the rest day, fun fact, I don't think JV knows how much he did for German cycling. So I'm curious to know what exactly he has done for German cycling. So Sonia at Leti, we will message you and arrange the phone call as best we can.
It could be something terrible. He could have done something terrible for German cycling.
That's a point. I hadn't thought of that. Well, I guess we'll find out after the phone call. We'll tap it.
She's got a bone to pick with Jonathan Vorden.
we're journalists. We know how to hack phones. We can listen in.
How is this? I'm intrigued. I was intrigued by the difference between a brasserie and a bistro, but I'm also intrigued by the modalities of this phone call. How is it going
to
work?
By the way, we don't really know how to hack phones. How does the phone call work? Well, yeah. Jonathan Vorders,
what time? What number? Do you call him on his mobile? Do you call him on a landline?
We give him Sonia's number, and he picks up his phone, turns it on, phones it, and then...
Jonathan Vorders here. what do you want to talk about?
And they have a conversation. A conversation in shoes. And I think we've got a competition next week to win a phone call from Dan Martin on the rest day. So that's something to look forward to.
Now, talking about rest days, people may assume that tomorrow is a day off for everybody on the tour. It doesn't often work like that, does it? So what are we going to be doing on the rest day, Richard?
Well, it is a day off for the Telegraph Cycling Podcast supported by Jaguar, but we will be moonlighting as the Velo News Cycling Podcast supported by Jaguar, and we'll be doing a podcast with our American colleagues, Matt Bowden and maybe Andy Hood as well, so that will be available on Tuesday at some point. We'll be back podcasting for the Telegraph on the next stage, Wednesday.
Interviews and analysis. We've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast supported by Jaguar.
I thought of that when Tony Martin was asked in his press conference about Denis Menchov. He'd never rode in a team with Denis Menchov. As far as I know, he doesn't know Denis Menchov. Denis Menchov was busted for doping a couple of days ago. Tony Martin was asked about Denis Menchov, which I thought was pretty much as tenuous as asking any journalist about Andy Coulson phone hacking, etc. I think you can ask Tony Martin about himself and about his own ethics and so on, but asking about Denis Menchov,
or if it was a teammate or a close friend, I think that's fair game. But yeah, I mean,
do you disagree, Daniel?
I think you should be allowed to ask whatever you want in a press conference, but I also think it's his prerogative to respond in the way that he wants to.
He could have answered the question a lot better. He said he wanted to concentrate on his win. It would have been easy for him to condemn Menchov and say, I'm glad that cheats are caught, etc. I'm just saying that the idea that there's some link, some connection between Tony and Martin, purely on the basis that they are both professional cyclists, is, I think, wrong. And that's not to say that he shouldn't be asked a question, that he shouldn't have answered it better. But the rest is, I mean, they're actually more hectic and busier than race days. There are numerous press conferences, starting with Team Sky at 10 a.m, which is a good hour, over an hour away from where we're sitting, so it's a reasonably early start. There are press days throughout the day.
A 15-minute press conference.
A 15-minute press conference.
15 minutes with
might,
Team Sky.
I might boycott that, if I'm honest. I might boycott that. But anyway, there are press conferences throughout the day, and you go around. I mean, we've all got press conference stories. My favourite was 2007 when it was a pretty tumultuous tour. Michael Rasmussen was in the yellow jersey. We were in Po, and Rasmussen was under fire. There was a lot of doping suspicion around him, and he held a press conference in the morning in Po with the Rabobank team lawyer present, which was unusual in itself. And that was the story, you know, yellow jersey under fire, what's he got to say for himself? Went to the press conference, wrote our stories, and I was with colleagues, William Fullerian of The Guardian and Brendan Gallagher, then of The Telegraph, and we were sitting in a lovely place just outside Po, a spa, and William had booked us in for an afternoon spa.
Are you sure you want to admit this, really?
Spa and massage, and there we were in our white toweling gowns in this place with the sound of birdsong and waves crashing against the shore, relaxing music.
Po is not on the coast, the last time I checked.
No, it was a soundtrack. It was a CD, Daniel. It was a CD. And we were getting pampered. And, you know, it was a lovely bit of relaxation. Third week of the tour, just what we needed. Never done that before or since, I should add. That's not a regular occurrence. That's why I'm seeing travel with The Guardian. Anyway, we had this lovely hour sort of repose, respite from the tour. Came out of the place, the facility, white tiling gowns discarded, clothes put back on, turned our phones on all at the same time, and they all started bleeping. And of course, we'd missed the real story of the day, which was Alexander Vinokourov of Astana busted for getting busted for blood doping.
Well, yeah, that was a pretty incredible day because we just finished the Michael Rasmussen press conference when the news broke there that Alexander Vinokourov and the Astana team were being raided by the police, I think.
Well, the news broke. There was a Sornier Deval press conference, which was attended by David Miller, Iban Mayo, and another rider who I think might have been Christopher Renero. And they'd called a press conference primarily to announce some kind of charity initiative, which was to do with, I don't want to be flippant about this, but it was something to do with rainforests. And
they were planting a million trees,
right,
or something.
Yeah, and we'd been briefed. We were only to talk about rainforests and trees for the first 20 minutes. And as always, when big news breaks in the press conference, there was a kind of buzz, a sort of hubbub.
a hubbub.
Yeah. There was clearly something going on. So everyone who was paying attention to the press conference was aware that something was going on behind them. A few of us got up, went to talk to some of our colleagues. We found out that Vinokourov was... had tested positive for a blood transfusion, and then we talked earlier about rude interruptions. I very rudely interrupted, I think, the Sornier Deval team manager's kind of treatise about rainforests and planting trees by asking David Miller what he made of the news that Alexander Vinokourov had just tested positive. I think David talks about this in his book, actually. And he was crestfallen, and obviously then the whole sort of tenor of the press conference changed.
Yeah, and you heard the chairs moving and people scuttling towards the door. And I remember driving over there and getting there, and the police cars were already outside. And what was the name of the Astana manager at that time? Mark Beaver, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The bald-headed guy. And it was absolutely mobbed with press outside the front of the hotel. The police were sort of marching in. They were taking things away, cool boxes and luggage and all sorts of things, putting it in the back of their cars. They actually took a couple of the riders away in a car as well. And most of the bigger name riders, Kasheshkin and Alexander Vinokourov, had already gone by the time the media got there. But one of the funny moments there was that Mark Beaver sort of stood on the steps of the hotel and shouted that there would be a press conference in the garden in 5 minutes. And this whole throng of journalists, TV cameras, all muscling their way through. They were told they couldn't go through the hotel. All muscling their way through between a tree and the edge of the hotel, like this little narrow gap, funneling through. It took about 10 minutes for everyone to get through there, and they all stood in the garden. And I just stood at the back, keeping half an eye on the garden and half an eye on the front of the hotel. And while everyone was gathered in the garden, the police brought the rest of the riders out and put them in a van and took them away. It was like, if you're looking for how easy it is to con us as journalists, it's pretty simple.
We shouldn't laugh, but at the time it was enormously stressful. We can make light of it now. I do remember Vino's quote that one of the rumours was that his father had arrived on the race for the Albi time trial, which he won, and one of the rumours was that he had taken blood from his father. And he said, "That's ridiculous. If I'd taken blood from my father, I would have tested positive for vodka." But this links back to what we've been saying a lot on this tour about the debilitating effect of crashes. Vinokourov, that tour, had a couple of absolutely terrible crashes. He was like an Egyptian mummy. He was covered in bandages. He was in a terrible, terrible, terrible state. And he got better. He won a couple of stages.
I remember the stage. I forget where it finished, but the stage, it was Tom Simpson's birthday, and Bradley Wiggins spent almost all of the day in the break. And I think that might have been the day after Vinokourov had crashed really badly. And he almost had to be surgically removed from his saddle. He just couldn't get off his bike. He was in so much pain.
And then he won two stages, including that time trial, where I think Bradley Wiggins finished fourth or fifth, behind Kasheshkin, Andreas Klöden, Cadell Evans. He finished fifth behind Vinokourov, Kasheshkin, Klöden, Evans, Wiggins.
It's not going to be like that tomorrow on the rest day, is it? The landscape has changed somewhat.
One hopes not, although Vinokourov is obviously still around managing Vincenzo Nibali's team, which does, it does raise questions. We asked Chris Baldwin about this, the Astana press man, in our long extended 4-hour interview, and he actually had some very, very interesting things to say about Vinokourov himself and about the culture in Kazakhstan where Vinokourov and the team is based.
Yeah, he did. What did he? What was it he said? Other than that, Vinokourov writes poetry. He said that the culture in Kazakhstan is completely different, and they don't have this kind of situation where you pay a penalty forever for a transgression. The idea is that he had basically been caught, he'd served his time, and now he's perfectly legitimately allowed to return to whatever activity he wants. And that's how they see it, which is slightly different.
You know what, Lionel? I think we'll dig out that bit of the interview with Chris Baldwin and we'll play it in one of the podcasts because it was interesting. And you know, Chris Baldwin is an American guy who works for Astana. The way that he got involved in that team is interesting itself. He bumped into Alexander Vinokourov at the Tour of Turkey 1 year and began speaking Russian to him. And Vinokourov was quite staggered that this American guy spoke Russian, and they got chatting and he ended up working for the team. It's an interesting story. But he has a very, you know, a deep knowledge of Russia and Kazakhstan and that part of the world, and his perspective on it is fascinating. So I think we'll try and get him on.
I don't want to preempt what may happen in the coming days, but it is noticeable that Vincenzo Nibali has not been asked about doping yet. He's been in the yellow jersey a long time. He's had one day off from the yellow jersey, basically. If a Sky rider had been in the yellow jersey, the atmosphere on the tour would have been completely different. Mm-hmm. And yet Nibali is riding for a team part owned and run by Alexander Vinokourov, who tested positive, served a ban. Contador, who until today was the most likely challenger, riding for a team run by Bjarne Riis, who didn't test positive but confessed to doping, said he doped when he won his Tour de France in 1996. And it's really interesting how this tour is playing out much more positively, yet the links to doping are far stronger in the case of Astana and Tinkoff Saxo. It's strange, to say the least, at the moment.
Something for us to think about on the rest day, isn't it, Lionel? Well, I think we have to wrap up the podcast, don't we? Not that we don't want to talk about this, but I think time has come that sad.
I think the problem is if you start talking about this, you can't stop, can you? I mean, we talk about this a lot off air, as it were, and about how to discuss it in the podcast.
Well,
in
we've got an hour's drive to our hotel.
We'll
flesh
it out properly one day in the podcast, won't we?
Yeah, we will. Yeah. And so let's wrap it up there. As I say, we'll be taking a day off Telegraph podcasting on Tuesday on the rest day, but we'll be back on Wednesday with our daily podcast. Until then, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard. Lionel Richie.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.